Welcome to Voice of Albion with Paul Hickman on the White Network.
Welcome to Voice of Albion on the White Network. Today we're going to do part two about the werewolf movement, the guerrillas who was fighting behind the lines for the German cause. On April 1945, the German station Radio Werewolf began broadcasting for the first time. It was created by propaganda minister Goebbels to rally the population to suicidal resistance. I did find one clip which was titled Radio Werewolf, 1st of April 1945. I've asked someone to translate it for me. It's only a minute and a half long, to find out if it is an authentic recording of such a broadcast. That person hasn't got back to me yet, so that's why I didn't play it, because I don't know exactly if it is the correct thing. As well as this propaganda, there was also a guerrilla combat manual written for troops in World War II. It has been translated by Lieutenant Michael Fagnum. I did find a PDF link to it, which gives both the English and German text. It isn't very clear, but anyone interested could have a look to get the idea of what it's like, and there are versions available to buy at Amazon. The description of the manual reads, "This is a reprisal of the classic guerrilla manual of Nazi Germany. It tells a story of Hitler's only organised resistance units, the SS Werewolf. It shows rare photos of their members, equipment and training areas, and reveals a storehouse of scarce info about the technical aspects of guerrilla warfare. It includes an extract, reprint, an exact reprint of the Werewolf manual and an English translation." The book I will be mainly citing today will be Charles Whiting's version about Operation Carnival, which was the mission assigned to the small group to kill the Burgomaster of Arkham, named Oppenhoff. That's okay, I think, because that was the most significant act for the werewolves. However, there were other detachments involved in other areas of Germany. A well-known book was published by Perry Biddiscombe called Werewolf, The History of the National Socialist Guerrilla Movement, 1944-46. On page 84 of his book, he writes, "SS Obersturmbannführer Paul Müller established a secret army composed of several hundred SS men in the Ruhr who called themselves Blue Falcons and dressed in blue shirts and trousers. Members of this movement established a number of arms caches, and they used the 88 greeting, a code for the eighth letter of the alphabet repeated twice, HH, which in turn signified the term Heil Hitler." Now, I don't know if that's true, that that was the first time 88 was used, before anyone comments. It must have started somewhere, though. I would have always thought it came out of modern America, you know, 1488, but if anybody knows, let me know. I'd be interested to find out. The werewolf operation and the notion of a last standing Bavaria was a successful misinformation tactic. By March 1945, the supreme headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force, SCHAFE, were taking the possibility seriously enough for Eisenhower to downgrade the strategic importance of Berlin, instead focusing on Bavaria. Even those who doubted the validity of the original OSS reports accepted it was wisest to act as if there was an Alpine redoubt, just in case. These illusions came to an embarrassing end in late April 45, when three German soldiers crossed the Elbe near Magdeburg and surrendered to the Allies, one of which was Lieutenant General Kurt Dittmar. When asked about the Alpine redoubt at his debriefing, Dittmar laughed and called it a romantic dream, it's a myth. Although initially sceptical, Schaeff soon came to accept the truth of his words. Meanwhile, Stalin steamrolled his way to Berlin. Now, the following is from a thesis written by Nicholas John Hurley of Connecticut University. He wrote it on published it on 12th of May 2019. 2013. The title is Terror, Unrealized, German Blunders, American Occupation Strategy, and the Failure of the Nazi Werewolf Movement. I'll post the PDF on the show page if anyone wants to see his sources. Some are good, like diary entries and official public records, and some are kind of more lightweight, such as newspaper articles. But that's, of course, is normal in an academic piece of work to include some newspaper articles, as long as there is more reliable primary sources, which he does include. He's quite critical, Nicholas John Hurley, of Whiting's book Werewolf. However, he does use it himself in his thesis, so he must have thought it was at least good in some parts. Anyway, this is from John Hurley. Dönitz finally made a proclamation on 5th of May over radios Copenhagen, Flensburg and Prague. The fact that at present an armistice reigns means that I must ask every German man, this is quoting Dönitz, and woman to stop any illegal activity in the Werewolf or other such organisations in those territories occupied by the Western Allies, because this can only injure our people. End quote. Goebbels wrote in his diary on 28th of March 1945, I am not satisfied with our Werewolf organisation. At my next interview with the Führer, I may well try to annex this organisation myself. I would impart more drive to it than it has at present. End quote. Some of the first to be arrested, the interrogation reports for the following individuals gave the US some of its first credible intelligence regarding Werewolf, as well as lists of other Germans suspected or known to the prisoners as being involved in subversive activities. And some of those arrested were SS Obergruppenführer Karl von Eberstein, arrested in May of 1945. Unwillingly, he was designated Werewolf Commissioner for all of southern Germany. SS Sturmbannführer Ernst Wagner, an officer of the Munich Criminal Police and subordinate to von Eberstein. He was appointed Werewolf Director for the Munich area in 1945. He was arrested by the CIC on May 8th, 45. And Obergruppenführer Jürgen Stroop of Wiesbaden was arrested as organiser of the Werewolf there, and he was in Bavaria when he was arrested in May 1945. The end of the winter of 1945-46 brought on a renewed offensive against subversive activity in the American zone. A sweep of the Bavarian Alpine region by US forces in April 1946 netted 9 Werewolf operatives, as well as a hit list of prominent individuals to be wiped out by the group. The largest and most successful undertaking by occupied forces was Operation Nursery in the spring of that year. The result of months of investigation by CIC agents and other occupation forces, Nursery broke the back of an underground network consisting of former Hitler Youth leaders led by Reich Youth Minister Arthur Axmann himself. Axmann, who had escaped the siege of Berlin and fled safe in May of 1945, worked actively in the last few weeks of the war to funnel as many Reich Youth leaders and members safe to Bavaria, with the intent of establishing a base for post-war guerrilla activity. Axmann himself was arrested at a roadblock in December of 1945 while travelling around southern Germany to coordinate activities amongst the various Werewolf cells of the area. Nursery raids in March 1946 netted a further 800 Werewolves, some surrendering only after gunfights with American forces. The result of the entire operation was the arrest of virtually the entire remaining Hitler Youth leadership by April of 1946, and the end of any Hitler Youth-inspired Werewolf activity in southern Germany. So that's the information from John Hurley, who wrote that in his thesis. I think we should remember that it was an underground operation as opposed to an official operation. The exception to that is Operation Carnival, which is what the second part of Whiting's book is all about. So, start. Ilse Hirsch felt that the Ardennes offensive was almost a personal reward for all the hard work she had done in the last few weeks since the German patrol had rescued her from the hunting lodge near Monchaux. All the help she had given in building bunkers and defensive lines in the Eiffel had been worthwhile after all, for it was in these bunkers that the 6th SS Panzer Army, now fighting deep inside Belgium, had hidden its equipment and men. Quick note, the Eiffel is a low mountain range in western Germany and eastern Belgium. Continue. For the time she rested in Cologne, her time divided between her door routine duties in the office of the local Hitler Maiden HQ and those few exhilarating moments standing expectantly around the Volksempfänger, People's Wireless. 2 days later, Ilse Hirsch found herself posted to Dusseldorf, Lohhausen, where she was ordered to report to Standartführer Raditz. The SS man received her kindly enough. He asked her to sit down and offered her a cigarette, which she hastily declined and said, "A German woman does not use maple, and a German woman does not smoke." Those were two of the lessons she had tried to drum into the teenage female charges of hers for years. The SS officer asked her how well she knew the Aachen area. She told him of her years in the area during the war and before, when she had worked as an apprentice in Umbridge's bookshop, a dozen or so miles from Aachen. The SS officer nodded thoughtfully and said, "We need women for our operations. You know, men cannot go out after curfew, but they wouldn't worry too much about a lone, harmless woman on the streets after hours." The SS man continued, "I think we can find a use for you, Fräulein Hirsch. I shall send you here to Schloss Hohlkraft near Erkelungslenz. Lieutenant Wenzel will meet you there. He'll put you in the picture about Operation Carnival." Ilse Hirsch has been born in the Ruhr industrial town of Hahn in 1922. Her father, a master tailor, lost his first wife, Ilse's mother, when she was 5. A short time later, the master tailor married again, and Ilse was packed off to boarding school. Ilse remained at her convent until she passed her secondary leaving certificate. She then did another year in a private college, again run by the Ursuline nuns, finally leaving to become a kindergarten nurse. At the age of 16, she had already joined the Union of German Maidens as a form of protest against the nuns who wanted party, not politics. Now in her spare time, she started to instruct the younger members of that organisation in handiwork, modelling and similar skills. They met in the evenings, working around a long table, their needles clicking busily as they knitted sweaters for soldiers on the Eastern Front. In 1941, her industry, dedication and artistic talents came to the attention of the older women who ran the organisation. She was asked to take over a group, and a year later she left her job with the Umbrists and became a full-time German maiden organiser, being posted to the nearby town of Monchaux, where she remained until early 1944. When Ilse Hirsch was set to Hohlkraft Castle in the winter of 1944 to prepare for Operation Carnival, she was 23 years old. Ilse Hirsch was a hardened and dedicated member of the NSDAP, who, although not concerned with its ideology, obeyed its dictates without question. She would not hesitate for one moment to kill someone if it was in the interest of the cause. A fanatic, in other words, and the brave one to boot. Well, that's Whiting saying she didn't have interest in the ideology. I would have thought she would have. Ilse took an instant dislike to Lieutenant Herbert Wenzel. Quick note, the hierarchy of the werewolves in the Rhineland was Commander SS General Gutenberger, liaison officer. Then you had SS Colonel Raditz. Then you had Lieutenant Colonel Neunhaus, who was CO. Then there was SS Lieutenant Wenzel, who was the training officer. And then you had the werewolf teams, who were made up of 5 men and 1 woman. The unit was made of both male and female personnel, some dressed in civilian clothes and others in uniform, without badges of rank or identification. save for the silver rooms of the SS. While Wenzel and Ilse Hirsch drove to St. Vith to Gutenberg's advanced headquarters, General Gutenberger himself was still at his main headquarters in the bunker at Dusseldorf, Lohorsen, a suburb of the fashionable Rhinish city, waiting for his orders to leave for Belgium. It was while he was waiting there that he received a telephone call from Himmler. Himmler was soon to take part in the Ardennes offensive himself. Another comment there, I'd heard of Hitler giving Himmler military command duties before, but thought it was a bit bizarre as Himmler didn't even fight in World War I. But it is confirmed in a book called Heinrich Himmler, A Life by Peter Longrich, and he writes on page 715, on January 21st, 1945, Himmler and his train went to Schneidermull, where he took up a new post. Hitler had appointed him Commander-in-Chief of the Army Group Vistula, end quote. I think the only reason for this was to prevent commanders raising the white flag, which is what that writer continues to suggest. With such a high-ranking person as Himmler there, that would be more less likely for that to happen. Continue. For the first time, the Führer had granted him the opportunity to exercise his powers of leadership in battle. In the first days of January, he was to launch a surprise diversionary attack on the Franco-American line in Alsace, near Strasbourg. But although he was excited by his new challenge, he did not forget his routine duties, nor his anger at the shocking way the party officials had acted at Aachen, thus allowing traitors like the new chief burgomaster of the city to spread poison among the German nation with the aid of the enemy press. Without waiting for Gutenberger to explain the situation, the Reichsführer irritably reprimanded him for his lack of action in the Aachen matter. But the situation at the front makes it very difficult to get anyone through, Herr Reichsführer, Gutenberg protested. Then send in your group by airman, he snapped, and Himmler hung up. While the Americans debated whether Oppenhoff was trustworthy and indeed an anti-Nazi, in quotes, a message from Berlin reached Gutenberger via courier. The message was from Himmler. The chief burgomaster of Aachen has been sentenced to death. The sentence is to be carried out by W, is what the letter said. In the first week of February 1945, Gutenberger set about the completion of the Aachen assignment. While the rumble of Allied guns in the Eifel grew louder and louder, giving a foretaste of the offensive soon to come, he gave orders to Wenzel to assemble the team for Operation Chief Burgomaster, as it had become known in Hallcroft. By now, the werewolf organisation was beginning to take shape. From Berlin had come the orders to create the 50 young men and women receiving training up into 6-man teams. Each team would consist of 4 men, 1 boy and 1 woman. The boy and woman members would act as scouts because, as Prutzmann stated, young boys and women raised little suspicion in the occupied territories. The men would be divided into 2 groups of 2, each man ready to carry out the duties of the other in case one was captured or killed. The woman member was an obvious choice, Ilse Kirsch. She made a best female scout. As his second in command, he realised he would need someone who was experienced in weapons, since he would have to carry out the assassination. In the end, he decided to pick his second-in-command from the handful of SS instructors. He picked SS Sergeant Joseph Liebbeg, a blonde Austrian from Innsbruck, who was in his early 30s. And this is at the castle where they was doing the training and recruiting, which is called Hallcroft. Having looked through the files, Wenzel went to the ice-patterned window, opened it and called down to one of the NTOs in the courtyard below, "Send up Erich Morgenschwies." Erich Morgenschwies had been born in the mining village of Merkstein, just outside Aachen, in 1928. After leaving, he refused to go into the mines after leaving school and enrolled at the Aachen College of Commerce. His second decision was to join the Hitler Youth. It was not long before he became a patrol leader. In 1945, as the Americans pushed close to the German frontier, he decided to join the Hitler Youth as a full-time youth leader. He was accepted and in November 1944 was sent to Schloss Hallcroft to be trained for the new secret guerrilla organisation. On 20th of February, the last two members of the six-man team arrived at the castle. The guides High Dorn and Heimann were provided by the Gestapo Lieutenant Schneider. The two guides were former border policemen who had been enrolled in the SS in the middle years of the war. Once the Allies reached Belgium in the summer of 1944, they had been employed as Fraunhofer, or front runners, men and women who knew the border area so intimately that they were capable of guiding agents, agitators, saboteurs and the like back and forth through enemy lines. Because they were threatened by an Allied push through the Eifel, it had been decided that the parachute drop for Operation Carnival would start from the Luftwaffe airfield at Hardoschheim near Brunswick and not from Dusseldorf. There, Luftwaffe Squadron 252 had captured enemy planes which would be used to carry them to their objective. Radax explained to the group gathered at Hallcraft that they would drop near the little Belgian village of Geminch, and from there it would be the guide's job to take the group around the outskirts of the city until they reached their base camp at the Pauzertrum, an area of woods and open pastures close to the German-Belgian frontier. Leaving Arkham, they would travel across country, plunging into the deep woods of the Eifel, avoiding inhabited places where possible. During the daytime, they would hide and rest in a number of lonely foresters' houses he knew of behind enemy lines, assuming that these would probably now be empty or abandoned due to the fighting. At night, they would attempt to cover as much ground as possible. If they were challenged, they would let the woman do the talking. However, if the Americans insisted on looking at their documents, they would produce the fake papers supplied by Steubenrauch and pretend to be workers of the Todt organisation. Quick note, the Todt organisation was a labour organisation made up of youngsters and old men not fit for military service. Politely, Gutenberg waited until Radetz and Wenzel were finished and then remarked, "Operation Carnival starts in 6 days." The survivors of Operation Carnival had little to say about the events of the next few days when they were questioned about it years later, first by British intelligence and then by the German public prosecutor. Out of the half-light loomed the gigantic shape of the American fortress bomber, and as Ilse Kirch got closer to it, bowed under the weight of the parachute and harness, she could see new metal patches everywhere, patching up the fabric. The crew swung themselves up into the aircraft, making it, with their years of practice, look very easy. The werewolf team followed, but rather more clumsily. When they were all in, the little green lamp in the control room began to flicker. The fortress rolled forward, its speed quickly increasing. In a moment they were gaining height, flying up into the clouds and darkness. The time was 9 o'clock on the evening of 20th March 1945. In another couple of hours, they would be over the drop zone. It did not take Ilse long to find out the name and address of the Burgomaster of Arkham. As soon as she arrived in the ruined city, she went straight away to her old apartment in the Hasselholz-Erdwig. It was a stupid thing to do. She had lived in the apartment for 6 months in 1944 while she had been employed as German maiden organiser in the city. Someone could have recognised and reported her to the police. By this time, the Americans had already set up their own police force, composed of elderly civilians whose badge of office was a wooden club and an armband. Like most empty or abandoned houses in Arkham, it had long been looted by the time or those who had remained in the city during the siege. That afternoon, she walked slowly out of the ruined town, past the hall, past the tall, grey three-storey bunkers, bearing the shell and bomb marks of last year's fighting, and began to climb the long hill which led to Kopfen. Occasionally, she met a woman or old man bent double under a load of twigs and branches from the nearby forest, or dragging a wooden cart filled with potatoes. Then she came upon the house 251 Eupenerstrasse, the house where Franz Oppenhoff, the traitor, lived. Swiftly, she ran her eye down the list of names written on carefully on a large sheet of paper nailed to the door. Later she was to learn that the Americans had made the inhabitants of every house in the city do this. There was a couple of names she did not know. those she sought was there, Oppenhoff, Franz, Oppenhoff, Irmgard, and then three other names, Monica, Christa, and Irmgard. She looked at the dates of birth for each name. Monica would be 8, Christa 7, and Irmgard still a baby. So the traitor had children. The fact did not alter her determination to go on with the mission, and she knocked on the door. A pretty dark-haired woman of about her age looked at her. "See, won't you?" she inquired. "What can I do for you?" "I've been walking for a long time, and I'm thirsty. I wonder if you could give me a glass of water." The woman, Oppenhoff's maid, Elizabeth Galesson, smiled and said, "Of course, follow me." After Ilse had disappeared, the werewolf group had reassembled in the wood and hidden in the undergrowth. Turning his head into the wind, Wenzel listened to ascertain if they were being followed, but there was no sound of any pursuit. "Heumann," slowly said, "I think we must be close to Arkham now, probably somewhere to the northwest of the city." "Where?" Wenzel snapped. "I don't know exactly, but I suggest we move off soon, and then I shall be able to spot the nearest landmark." After walking a while, they flopped down into an exhausted sleep, despite the damp and cold of the forest. In the early hours of the morning, they set off again, Heumann in the lead. Before the war, he had served as a border policeman at the little border station of Kotschen, not far from the Oppenhoff house, and he decided to take the werewolf team across the border once more into Belgian territory, where they could set up a base camp near his old station. On the morning of the 22nd, they set up camp in the Arkham Forest just outside of town and began to plan their next move. Ilse's disappearance had upset their plans. He would carry out the scout mission within the city itself. Ilse walked past the old labour exchange in the Augerstrasse, where she heard an urgent whisper behind her. "Ilse." She spun round quickly at the mention of her name, her heart in her mouth. It was Morgan Schwyz. His parachutist's overall was gone now, and although he was still wearing his oversized American rubber boots, he looked like any other youngster to be seen that day on the streets of the occupied city. "Ilse, we thought you were dead." "I thought the same about you," she cried to Morgan Schwyz. Franz Oppenhoff was tired. The constant conflict with the Americans, the dangers presented by the Ardennes offensive, the long winter and the lack of food had all taken their toll. When his wife and children had at last dared to return to the city in February, Irmgard Oppenhoff was shocked by the change in her husband's appearance during the 6 months he had been chief burgomaster. In the early hours of Saturday morning, the werewolf team moved to its last camp, crossing the Eupenstrasse once more and taking a position in the woods near the small Belgian village of Hosset, some 90 minutes on foot from Oppenhoff's house. Everything was now planned. The boy, Ilse, and Heidorn would remain in the camp while Wenzel and Hitgeb would carry out the mission, guided by Heumann. Thanks to Ilse, they now knew the only danger to their plan was the presence of an AMI, that's American General's HQ, close to the traitor's house. Afternoon came, and high overhead the conspirators heard the drone of heavy planes. It went on for hours, and once or twice Morgan Weiss was tempted to go out into the open space to have a look at the enemy planes flying eastwards, but Wenzel told him to keep under cover. In a few hours, as soon as darkness fell, they would be off. In the Eupenstrasse, the Sunday passed pleasantly for the Oppenhoff family. In the morning, they went to church to listen to Palm Sunday Mass, and afterwards, Irmgard Oppenhoff gave her husband a good meal of onions and potatoes, followed by real bean coffee, with 3 spoons of sugar as an extra treat. Apart from the few occupied houses about them, the suburb was a deserted, ruined city. Swiftly, they made their way through the wood, crossed the Belgian-German frontier, and headed for the Eupenstrasse. It was a tight, moonlit night. Heinemann, who knew the road like the back of his hand, made good time, so that they arrived at their destination shortly after 9. Silently, they sneaked across the garden, which separated them from the Oppenhoff house. At once, Wenzel found the cellar door that Ilse had told him about, It was locked. He released the handle and looked at a window nearby. It was small, but both he and Seb were slim enough to get through. "The window," he whispered. Wenzel applied pressure. With a loud click, the catch gave. Swiftly, he crawled through the open window and dropped down the other side. Seb followed him in, then closed the window behind. The SS officer switched on his flashlight and shone it around the cellar. Cautiously, they climbed the stone cellar steps and found themselves in a small hallway. Wenzel set his foot carefully on the first step of the wooden staircase leading to the next floor, where presumably the bedrooms were. They came to the first door. Moving very deliberately, Wenzel nodded to the Austrian to get ready. Then, pressing his body against the wall, he reached out and slowly opened the door. Seb flashed his blue light inside. "Kids," he whispered. Wenzel looked over his shoulder. 3 children lay curled up beneath the heavy German goose-filled quilts. He closed the door, and on the tips of their toes they moved to the next door. The room was empty, as was the next. Wenzel's train of thought was broken by Heidegger's urgent whisper. "Listen, there's someone in there." Wenzel pushed the door. "Who's there?" The voice was feminine, young and scared. A young woman with dark hair was sitting up in bed. "Where's the Burgomaster Oppenhoff?" he asked. Elisabeth Gillensen was frightened, out of her wits. "He's not here," she stammered. "Where is he then?" "Next door, at our neighbour's, at the Faust house." Then he got up and said, "Fetch him." Wenzel turned to Leutgeb. "Turn off the torch," he commanded. Then to the girl, "Get dressed. We'll wait for you downstairs." "Herr Oppenhoff, there are American soldiers. They want to speak with you now." The maid believed them to be American soldiers and had opened a door to the room where the Oppenhoffs were sharing schnapps with their neighbours. "All right, Elizabeth," he said, "I'm coming." Pulling on his gloves and straightening his armband, he turned to Faust. "You speak English, Faust. You'd better come with me." Faust rose to his feet, and together the two men went outside to where the maid was waiting. Oppenhoff gave her the key to the cellar door. "You open it," he said. "Now, where are they?" The maid did not need to answer his question. The 3 strangers stepped into the path and asked directly, "Are you Burgomaster of Aachen?" They spoke German. Faust said in English, "What do you want?" Wenzel replied in German, "We're not Americans. We're German airmen. We were shot down near Brussels 3 days ago. Now we're trying to make our way back to German lines. What about getting us passes, Herr Burgomaster?" Oppenhoff shook his head. "I can't do that. You should report to the Americans and give yourselves up. The war's nearly over anyway. It's only a matter of days." Abruptly, Leutgeb snapped, "Heil Hitler." Faust, standing next to Oppenhoff, started. It was a long time now since he had heard that greeting. Somehow, at this time of night and in this place, it frightened him. He stared warily at the 3 men while Oppenhoff continued talking, noting that one had a pistol stuck in his pocket. It was a German Walther pistol. He noted too that none of the 3 wore badges of rank on their uniform jackets, and all 3 were bareheaded. At last, the maid got the door of the cellar open. "Don't be alarmed, Elizabeth," Oppenhoff attempted to calm her. "They're German flyers. Make them a couple of sandwiches if you can find something." Then, turning to the 2 men Heinemann had moved away, he said, "Just a minute, I'll help her." He followed her down the stairs into the darkness. In the light of the moon, Wenzel's face suddenly went pale. "Yes, now," he replied hoarsely. Almost hesitantly, he drew his pistol with its long silencer. There were sounds from below. It was Oppenhoff coming back. The footsteps were getting closer. Leutgeb and Wenzel crouched close to the cellar door. Suddenly the traitor appeared in front of them, but Wenzel did not fire. "You cowardly so," the Austrian cried, and snatched a pistol from him. Swiftly, Leutgeb thrust the pistol at Oppenhoff's head. He levelled the pistol directly at the Burgomaster's left temple. An instant's hesitation, and then he fired. "There's someone coming," Wenzel whispered, rousing himself from the trance he had been in since Leutgeb had seized the pistol from him. "Let's go." A patrol from a nearby Signal Corps unit was out looking for a break in the line where Leutgeb had snipped through the wires. They had spotted Heinemann crouched in the shadow of a tree and opened fire at once. With all his strength, Heinemann pelted across the fields. Behind him he could hear shots, and white tracers began to rip through the night. At last he reached the shelter of a tree-lined street. He sprinted across the Upernstrasse and into the fields on the other side. Suddenly he became aware of someone running behind him. He drew his pistol. The dark figure came closer. Heinemann's finger curled around the trigger. Then he saw that it was Wenzel. "Where's Sepp?" "On the other side of the road. He's all right." Together they continued running. Imgard Oppenhoff's hand flew to her mouth and stifled the cry when she saw her husband lying crumpled on the steps. Operation Carnival was over. Late on the afternoon of 28th of March, high dawn guided them round the little town of Schilden, led them through the woods towards the teeny hamlet of Olef and into further trouble. Ilse Hirsch was partially plodding her way through the thick undergrowth just to Heidorn's right when she stumbled. There was a sudden sheet of flame followed by a thick crump, and he felt a heavy blow to the arm. As he fell, gasping with pain, he realised that Ilse had bumbled against a tripwire attached to her mine. They had been hit. Morgan Schwees in the back and hand, Ilse in the right knee. "You'd better go, you can leave me here. I'll call out," Ilse said. For Ilse it was all over. Her comrades had left her. The next day she was found. A farmer heard weak cries coming from the forest in the early hours of the morning. Heinemann and Heidorn succeeded in swimming the Rhine, only to be picked up by an American patrol and set of all places to an internment camp at Aachen. There, however, they succeeded in convincing their captors that they were harmless and were soon once again fleeing in an effort to return to their wives in what was soon to become the Russian zone of occupation. Morgan Schwees recovered from his wounds quickly. After only 10 days in hospital, he found refuge with an old Hitler Youth friend in the village of Mechernich. Here, he openly boasted about his exploits during Operation Carnival, but no one believed him. Ilse Hirsch took longer to recover. Her lungs were failing badly, but she had to enter a sanatorium for a long period. Finally, she was released from hospital, and after staying with a woman who had befriended her in the ward, she took the opportunity presented by a truck driver to Hahn, her hometown, to return to her parents. In the end, Prutzmann resigned himself to the inevitable. A few days after, he allowed himself to be captured by the British. Prutzmann was the highest ranking person involved in the operation. He planned it. But the thought of spending his life in internment camps was apparently too much for him. Though he was thoroughly searched before he entered the camp, he managed to smuggle in a cyanide capsule. The Aachen werewolf trial started inauspiciously enough. On 14 February 1947, Dr. Hitzer, Aachen's public prosecutor, was told by the British security officer that a boy named Eric Morgenschwees, who was in British custody, was suspected of having murdered the first Allied burgomaster of Aachen, Herr Oppenhoff. The five bulky files pertaining to the case showed that he had left no stone unturned in his attempts to find the murderers and their motives. One by one he found the werewolves and the men who had trained them. Gutenberger was easy. He was already in British hands, serving a 12-year sentence for war crimes. Heinemann was soon captured and was interned in the same camp as Morgan Schwees. Ilse Hirsch was also found and imprisoned without difficulty. She told the officers who came to arrest her that an old lady came into the Umbrick bookshop and told me that the Aachen public prosecutor was looking for me. If I'd wished to escape, I could have. Lieutenant Colonel Neunhaus was also questioned. Then Radatz was discovered, working as an interpreter for the British troops in Siegen. Not far away in Buchberg, Heidorn, who had returned from the Russian zone after divorcing his wife, was found working in, of all places, the kitchen of a local RAF Malcolm Club. But it proved impossible to trace SS Lieutenant Herbert Wenzel, although the persistent Dr. Hitzer checked with every German and Austrian university. The trial opened to a packed court on Thursday, 18th October 1949, in a Germany just regained its independence as the Federal Republic. Karl Gutenberger received 4 years, Karl Radatz 3, Heinemann was sentenced to 18 months, and Heidorn got 1 year. Ilse Hirsch and Johannes Stubenrock were set free. In effect, none of the accused, save Karl Guttenberger, served their sentences. Under the determined leadership of Dr. Ole Lert, the accused lawyers fought the sentence and in 1952 managed to have it reduced to a few months. In each case, so that the accused, who immediately after the war had all done time in internment camps, were released forthwith. In 1972, when Werewolf was written, the author wrote, "Today they are all alive and well, same Karl Guttenberger, who died in 1961. Ilse Hirsch is married to a civil servant and has two teenage children. She lives only 20 miles or so away from the most momentous scenes in her life. Karl Raddatz ended up teaching, as Guttenberger predicted, in 1945. Heidorn is still working, but Heinemann has retired. Erich Morgensweet is as youthful as ever, in spite of his 42 years. So that's the end of our two-part series on the werewolves. There is more information available about other activities which other kind of pockets of resistance did, which all kind of comes under the umbrella term. But it's hard to confirm about assassinations of other mayors. That's what you hear about a lot. Other mayors like Oppenhofer who collaborated with the Allies. But Operation Carnival is definitely a fact. It did happen. And there seems to be a fair few sources around to confirm the events, although it is a little patchy because it being a secret operation and all. And of course the kind of myth has grown around it since. So now I'll play out with a speech by Richard Edmonds, who spoke at the Scottish National Front branch meeting just a week or two ago. So I'll play out with that now. Thanks for listening. Take care. 14 words.
Thank you, fellow nationalists. Thank you for the invitation to speak here in Bonnie, Scotland. We're all British nationalists here. A lot of us are very, very British. I'll just tell you two slight things about myself. I could call myself a very British individual. My father's mother was a Welsh woman, and my mother's mother came from Edinburgh. So I'm a very British sort of person, like most of us here. It's an honour and a pleasure to speak at this National Front meeting. The National Front is the voice of the British people. We will be with the British people from beginning to end in this business, I have no doubt. The National Front was formed almost 50 years ago. The National Front has had ups and downs like any other organisation. The National Front has struggled with the problems of the British people, and I will say the British people have got two problems. First of all, they are absolutely lied to by their so-called leaders, these so-called politicians. The British people are absolutely lied to day after day after day. For at least 50 years, they've been lied to day after day. And the second problem the British people have got is that they are demoralised. Any people that is lied to day after day by the media, the press, the television, and their elected politicians, any people who's lied to every day for at least 50 years is going to end up confused and demoralised. And if you wonder, as we all wonder, all of us in this movement have given up this day and have given up a great deal more to be active in this movement. We've all wondered, why did the British people put up with it all? We've all tried to answer this question, why did we put it up with it all? Why did 55 million Britons? We conquered the world once. We took civilization to the world. We had a worldwide empire. We took civilization to the world, and we're so generous. When they asked us to leave, we left. I was in a public house last night with a couple of friends, and it was so pleasant and so civilised in a suburb of Edinburgh, or just beyond Edinburgh actually. Very civilised. Now where I come from, I'm a Londoner, it is dreadful, absolutely dreadful. dreadful and being destroyed. London is being destroyed in front of my eyes. I've lived in London most of my life. For those of you who might be interested and haven't yet seen it, I've got here what I call my visiting card. I stood as a National Front candidate in a parliamentary by-election in London a year ago. And if you haven't got it, if I haven't yet given it to you, and you'd like one of my what I call visiting cards, this is the leaflet that we published in the parliamentary by-election in Croydon North. We put out thousands of these by hand, and the post office put out thousands more. I was inspired to stand in this by-election in Croydon because I live about 2 miles from Croydon, and I happen to live on a hilly part of London called Sutton, and Croydon is in the valley below. Now, one night, I saw a sight, which most people found absolutely terrifying, but a sight that I knew was always going to come. 3 years ago, there were major riots in London, which lasted for 3 whole days and nights. The authorities didn't give a damn, the police chief didn't do anything, the politicians didn't do anything. And I was listening to my little radio set, and it suddenly said on my radio set, 10:30, on a warm August night, 2011, it said, Croydon is burning. I live about 2 miles from Croydon. Croydon town centre is burning. So I went out of my house, walked down the road a short while, from here to the end of the block, and because I'm on a hill and Croydon's in the valley, and because it was about 10:30 at night, you could see Croydon burning. Whole blocks were being set alight, whole blocks. And people were coming out of their houses, they'd obviously seen it on their television sets, and they were gawping. In fact, I walked up and down the whole road. I walked down the road towards the burning Croydon, because we're on a sort of slope, with everybody staring at Croydon. When I got to the bottom of the road, I turned around and walked up the hill again, so that I had burning Croydon behind me, and I was looking into people's faces. And I was the only person in that street who didn't have, my God, I never thought I'd see Croydon burn, because I've always known it was going to burn. That's why I'm a nationalist. I then stood in a parliamentary by-election in this town, Croydon. Now I'll tell you, Croydon North is what the Americans call a crime zone, a riot zone, and a white flight zone. Because all the whites, or most of the whites who get out of Croydon North, don't live there. There are two population groups live in Croydon, the Asians and the blacks. Now it was the underclass who was setting all the shops alight. Setting and committing murder and looting the shops and setting them alight. Oh, the whole block went up. And I campaigned as an act of defiance. National Front in a riot zone and a crime zone. And I calculated, because one has to calculate in this business, I calculated that there'd be no love lost between the Asians and the Asian shopkeepers and, shall I say, the underclass, the criminal underclass, who regularly mug people in Croydon, muggings and murders, and who set all the shops alight. And I and a team, we put out thousands of leaflets, not a single complaint. Because we went to the areas which are mixed Asian and white. We didn't go to the black areas. I didn't think I'd get many votes in the black areas. But I did think I could put out thousands of National Front leaflets in the other areas, and so it turned out. So if you want one of these leaflets, I'll go back to what some of the earlier speakers said, and I will concede the National Front has had tremendous ups and downs, because we are grappling with the demoralisation of British people. Only a totally demoralised people will put up with this, and put up with politicians who let the criminals burn and riot and murder for 3 days. 3 days and three nights it went on. Until in the end, when the criminal underclass had smashed every shop in their area, and when they went to buy some fags or a bottle of milk, all the shops were burnt out. That's when the riot stopped. The riots literally burnt themselves out. That's London. Yes, when you're trying to grapple with a totally demoralised people, and only a totally demoralised people will put up with all this, You had some ups and downs. And the secret, the National Front was formed almost 50 years ago. And the secret has been, we have the power of endurance. We can put up with the lies and the insults and all the nonsense. We have resilience. We bounce back. And we persevere. We persevere. So that's a little introduction to me and to why I do all this business. What I'd like to say now, I'd like to focus on the here and now. And I discussed with Dave and I discussed with Kevin when they asked me, you know, when we discussed this meeting. And I will say to you, there are two major elections taking place this year, and they are both very, very dangerous for us. Dangerous for a country which is moving towards its death. The whole white race is moving to its death, there's no doubt about that. The birth rate in Britain, the birth rate in the United States, the white birth rate in Britain, the white birth rate in the United States of America, the white birth rate in France, the white birth rate in Germany, etc., etc., is very low. You've heard Dave talk about the problems of Muslims and others have problems. The whole white race, in particular us here in Britain, which is our concern because we're British, is facing great dangers. And these two elections this year present great dangers for us. We all know that the purpose of Alex Salmond and his so-called Scottish Nationalist Party is they aim to break up the United Kingdom. They hope that this referendum later this year will sever, like a bloody knife and a piece of meat or a body, sever Scotland from the rest of us, which would be an absolute tragedy for many, many reasons. I will echo the words of Bixie, wherever Bixie is. Where's he gone to? Oh, beside him. I can't believe this bloke in the audience. He's beside me. No one I could see. He's beside me. We have been together for thousands of years. We are a united people. We've been here for thousands of years. There are stone monuments in Britain built by our ancestors. Stonehenge was built 4,000 years ago. Stonehenge. There are monuments in the very north of Scotland. There are monuments across in Ireland, built by our ancestors, thousands of years ago. Our ancestors, us, men and women exactly the same as us, who've kept this going, kept our race going, through all sorts of difficulties. So, we're a great people, we're a great people. With regard to this coming referendum, I will say this, I'll use the word we, but I'm obviously speaking of myself, but I speak for the National Front, I know that. We trust, because the National Front believes in the unity of the British people. Together we are strong. We live in a very, very dangerous world, and together we are strong. There's every reason to reject Salmond and his referendum, and we trust the good people of Scotland that they will see the paramount need to reject Salmond, and to maintain the union. Scotland and England have been united formally ever since James the First. Your James the Sixth became our James the First. That was in the 1603, and then in 1707 there was a political act of union. We've been together for hundreds of years. As I say, my father, my mother's mother came from Edinburgh. You've got me because my grandmother. I remember the woman. Very good woman. I remember. She's still alive when I was a kid. Yeah, I could tell you about my grandmother, a remarkable woman, my grandmother. Saying that she's only born in Edinburgh is just the beginning of what my grandmother, she's a remarkable woman. Anyway, stick on to this. Question, this is the question. We're in politics. We come to these meetings and we support this movement because we understand the importance of politics. Britain, all of our problems come down to politics because that trash, traitor trash, Westminster and elsewhere, they are responsible, as earlier speakers have said, they're responsible for everything. They're responsible for everything. The question is, where do the Scottish National Party, where do they get their audacity from? The audacity to attempt to break up the United Kingdom. Where do they get the boldness and the insolence, the energy and the confidence to break up the United Kingdom? Excuse me. Where do they get all this from? The energy, the fierce energy, the confidence that they can do it, the method and the means to break up the unity of the British people. Where does that come from? When you look at Salmond on the television, Hey, where does it come from, the energy and the confidence? It comes from the European Union. The European Union gives them that confidence. The European Union was set up from day one in the early 1950s. I remember it being set up. The very purpose of the European Union was made absolutely clear by its founder members in about 1954. It was founded. The whole purpose was, from day one, quite openly spoken out, was to merge and to submerge the traditional countries and nations of every country in Europe, definitely including Great Britain, and to form a super state to which we were to hand over our sovereignty, our independence. We were to hand over the right to rule ourselves, hand all this over until we cease to become a sovereign, independent nation and degenerate down to a province to be ruled from Brussels. Now, we know all about provinces, as once we had a British Empire, we ruled all these other countries with us, with the British people here in Britain doing the ruling. Now the whole thing is being turned upside down and we're being ruled from somewhere else. That was the open idea of the European Union from day one. Rule from Brussels, whether you like it or not. They're completely open about it. Now, we all know that the traitor trash, you understand the politicians, Labour, Tory, Liberal Democrat, Scottish Nationalist Party, the traitor trash at Westminster and elsewhere, they've taken us a long way down the road to our subjugation to Brussels. I am old enough to remember, I happen to be 71 years of age actually, it's just amazing really. I'll tell you this, you want to know, time goes remarkably quick. Do take advantage of it every day and every week, because bingo, it does go quick, you know. I have a job remembering all sorts of things. What century are we in? What millennium are we in? 1990s something? Is it? No, it's gone past the 1990s. Anyway, it does have some advantages. I remember traitor, Tory traitor, those two words go together, Tory traitor. I remember Tory traitor Ted Heath. When Ted Heath took this country into the European Union, which at the time was deliberately, misleadingly called the common market. Just a common market, a trading bloc, and Ted Heath got us into that by lying to the British people and saying, it's only a trading bloc. There is no political agenda to the common market. Now, anybody and everybody who took a serious interest in politics knew back then in 1972 or 3, anybody knew back in 1972, 73, that the European Union, the founding members, had a very political open agenda. That they were going to merge, they intended, it was quite open, merge, submerge every European country, including Britain, into a super state to be ruled from Brussels. And Ted Heath just openly lied. Question. Look, Britain is a great country. We've done amazing things in the past, just amazing, as Britain. Not England or Wales or Scotland or Ireland or Ulster, but as Britain. We've done amazing things. It was the British who founded the Industrial Revolution. This standard of living that we've got, the electricity and trains and all the rest of it, was the genius of the British people. Our genius. James Watt, for example, who was a Scotsman, right? Okay, let's have some credit here. James Watt, one of those who founded, who understood the power of steam engines. Someone's got to think these ideas up. He was a Scotsman, James Watt. When you talk about electricity, you've got amps and you've got volts, you've got watts. That's named after James Watt, the Scotsman. We laid the foundations for the present modern world. All this technology comes from Britain. We founded it 200 years ago. So how have they managed to get the surrender of our country, which no one has managed to do for 1,000 years? As an Englishman, you know, go back to 1066, that's when most Anglo-Saxons got our skulls bashed in by William the Conqueror. I don't think he actually got as far as Scotland, did he? Eh? Bonnie Scotland, he didn't get as far as here, did he? Didn't back your skulls in, just bashed our skulls in. That was 1066. But since then, no one's come over here and bashed our skulls in. For 1,000 years, we've been independent. So how have they done all this? Answer? The traitor politicians at Westminster have yielded, surrendered Britain up. The traitor Tory Ted Heath, he got Britain in under lies. The next Tory traitor, and those words always go together with a hyphen in between, Tory traitor was Margaret Thatcher. She, when she was Prime Minister, signed up the Act of Parliament called the Single European Act of Parliament. Single European. That Act of Parliament surrendered Westminster rule to Brussels. When people want to know why are we ruled from Brussels, why does Brussels' laws and regulations override our Westminster British laws and regulations, the answer is it was Margaret Thatcher, by signing up the Single European Act of Parliament, made Westminster, our Parliament, subservient to Brussels. She signed that up. The next Tory hyphen traitor was her successor, John Major. John Major, in the 1990s, signed up for the Maastricht Treaty. The Maastricht Treaty laid down the foundations of the economic and monetary union of the European Union. The Maastricht Treaty, which John Major signed up for, laid the foundations for the euro currency. Across the whole of the continent, they've got the euro currency. We've still got our financial independence with the pound sterling. There are powerful forces in Britain who want us to abandon the pound sterling and take up the euro. The euro is managed from the European Central Bank in Frankfurt, Germany. So we're ruled from Brussels, and the finances of Europe are controlled from Frankfurt, Germany. When, and it's coming, we drop the pound sterling and adopt the euro, we will then lose our financial independence. The next traitor, there was a switch, you know, it's a Tweedledum and Tweedledee. You get bored with this hand, you get bored with this puppet, they bring another puppet. They got rid of the Tories, they brought in that other traitor from the other traitorous party, Tony Blair. Tony Blair of the Labour Party, Labour Prime Minister. He won that election in 97, Tony Blair, and his slogan was, New Labour, New Britain. And a friend of mine, a lot cleverer than me, said, New Britain? What was wrong with the old Britain? And I thought, blimey, yeah, that's clever, isn't it? What was wrong with the old Britain? You know, I'm a bit slow, I need to have these ideas put in my head, but once they're in there, because I've got a thick skull, they stay in my head and go round and round and round and round my head. What was wrong with the old Britain? Tony Blair never told us. But the new Britain's coming, isn't it? Hey, the new Britain with the wicked, wicked, wicked politician. So, Tony Blair signed up the Lisbon Treaty in the year 2009. The Lisbon Treaty, you know, a lot of this is done with words. People look at the words and the words are a bit hazy. The Lisbon Treaty gave the European Union a legal personality. A legal personality. What does that mean, a legal personality? The Lisbon Treaty 2009, signed up by Tony Blair, gave the European Union the right to act as a political power in the world. It gave the European Union the right to sign agreements with other countries, the United States of America, the Russian Federation, China, whatever, as if the European Union was now a country in its own right. The European Union has got a president, and the European Union has got a foreign minister, all set up by the Lisbon Treaty of 2009. Now, I will say to you, I'll dot the I's and cross the T's for you, since you're kind enough to listen to me. All this has been done by stealth, lies and fraud. And I will say to you, it's been done by such stealth, the setting up of the European Union as a superpower to which we almost 9/10 or 99% surrendered our political independence. The European Union has been set up with such stealth, lies and fraud that although the European Union's got a president and a foreign minister, I wonder how many people. We all know President Obama in the US of A, right? Tall, skinny guy, tall and skinny as me, but a different view, you understand, right? You have got that, right? Otherwise, they're both tall and skinny, but there are one or two. There's a difference. Anyway, we all know President Obama of the USA. We all know President Putin of the Russian Federation. Does anybody know? There's been such lies and fraud and deceit and stealth. What's the name of the president of the European Union? He could declare war tomorrow. Do you know his name?
He's
a Belgian, isn't he? Van Rompuy. And the foreign minister is a Labour woman who's never been voted for anywhere, called Ashton. Lady Ashton, she calls herself. A Labour hack who's never won an election in Britain is now the foreign minister via NATO, could declare war tomorrow. No one knows their names. Because it's been done by such stealth and fraud. So, that's that. One final question. Right. Where do these ideas come from? Where do the ideas to submerge and destroy all the European countries with their history? France and Germany, Italy and Spain. Well, Italy goes back 2,000 years. The Romans had Hadrian's Wall up here. Britain goes back at least 1,000 years as a formal state. We go back thousands of years as the inhabitants of these islands. Where do the ideas come from to break up these states? The idea to submerge us and subjugate us, to turn us into a mere province of Brussels. Who dreamed the idea up? And what is the intended final outcome of the project of the European Union? It's coming. The final day when the countries of Europe, starting off with Britain, when we surrender the last of our national independence, I'm now going to tell you who dreamed this up and where it's all going to end. It was dreamed up after the First World War. The idea of the European Union. It was conceived in an individual's head in the 1920s after the First World War. The individual was a half caste. He had an Austrian diplomat for a father called Kudenhuber Piper Kalergi. The father was an Austrian diplomat. Kudenhuber spelled with a C. Hyphen Kalergi, spelled with a K. The mother was a Japanese woman called Mitsuko Ayama. The son of this union was born in Tokyo in the late 1890s, and he took his father's name. Kudenhuber with a C, hyphen Kalergi with a K. I would suggest, if you've got a computer, you look him up on Wikipedia. And I'm now going to quote to you what Kudenhuber Kalergi had to say about our future. Let's get this one thing clear. If you read the European Union, if you read what the founding fathers said, and if you read what the supporters say, they honour Kudenhuber hyphen Kalergi with his Japanese mother, born in Tokyo in the 1890s. They honour him as the spiritual father, the man who had the idea for the European Union. Obviously the Second World War put the whole project off the rails, but they soon had it back on again. In the early 50s they had the whole thing running again. The idea of submerging, dissolving, subjugating and destroying the traditional nations of Europe, including Britain. Question. What I'm aiming for. How did Kudenhuber Kalergi, the spiritual founder of the European Union, to which we've almost surrendered all of our national independence, how did he see the future? I advise you, if you've got a computer, look it up on Wikipedia. Here, I've printed it out. So I'll read it out to you, since you can't see what it said. I'll print it up. I printed this out the other day. I quote him, I can quote him, yeah? Yeah, you know what's coming, don't you? Yeah, good. Okay. This is what Kubenhuber said. I'm going to read it out now. Born in Tokyo, Japanese mother, Austrian diplomat for father. The man of the future will be mixed race. Today's races will disappear. The future race will be Eurasian Negroid. Meaning, part European, part Asian, part Negro. And the spiritual nobility and the leaders of Europe will be Jews.
Will be Jews.
If you've got a computer, listen, I used to be a school teacher, and I had to say to the lads, I only taught boys, I didn't teach girls. It's bad enough teaching boys, haven't I? Anyway, we'll keep this simple. I was saying to these lads, check it out, you know, do your homework and check it out. And I'd say to you, got a computer, Wikipedia, Kubenhuber, spelled with a C, hyphen, Kalergi, spelled with a K, his full name is Richard Nicholas von Kubenhuber, hyphen Kalergi. So there you have the blueprint for our destruction, thought up in the 1920s. He wasn't actually alone, but he's the guy that they give all the credit to. All the nations of Europe are to be broken up and ruled from Brussels, including Great Britain, to be broken up, which is what Salmon's all about, this referendum, of course. Chopping up Britain like a bit of meat, and then chuck it into the stewing pot. All the nations of Europe to be broken up and ruled from Brussels. Britain and Europe to be flooded with millions from Asia and Africa to breed us out, the mixed race of the future. And thirdly, all to be rolled over by, I quote very carefully, I'm quoting the exact words here, a new spiritual nobility. A new spiritual nobility and leaders of Jews. That's what he said. That was his blueprint in the 1920s, more or less 90 years ago. You recognize it? It's the world we live in, isn't it? The world that we live in. Now, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude now. I will conclude by saying that you opened up this meeting with a minute's silence to Chris Donnell, at the age of 15, abducted from the streets of Glasgow by a gang of Asians. They tortured him for hours. They stabbed him for hours. We know that he was alive when they poured petrol on him and set him alight, we know that. At the age of 15, I will now, with your leave, I will name four other young victims of the criminal multiracial society. The multiracial society is a crime because it was set up without any leave from us. I will name Ross Parker, stabbed to death by Asians in Peterborough. I will name Richard Everett, aged 15, stabbed to death by Asians in Somerstown, North London. I will name Christina Atkins, a schoolgirl, aged 15, stabbed to death on a bus in Birmingham at 7:30 in the morning, going to school, stabbed to death by an Asian. And I will mentioned the last name, will be a young man, Terry Gregory, age 19, stabbed to death on a bus in Woolwich, South London, by a black. Young people could be alive today, but for the deliberate flooding of our country by millions of foreigners who don't belong here. Fellow nationalists, speed the day that the trash traitors at Westminster and elsewhere who invited the whole world into our country to take us over, speed the day the trash traitors are voted out of office. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Voice of Albion on the White Network.